It's the 24th. Okay. And so we've been through reviewing the structure of agreements, and I would recommend that if you'd like to sort of do more of that, there are the other agreements, or look at any license agreement you have, and you will start feeling the tone. You will start seeing that they tend to hit the same high points in the same general order, most important to least important, specific to miscellaneous, and that they hit the same kinds of things because of what they are. Some will have confidentiality, others won't. Some will have terms, others won't. Those for consumers are more likely to be either very one-sided at the least, or they are even no signature required, as we've seen with some of the shrink wrap agreements. And we will be getting into drafting, but as I was about to say, it's even though it's great to be the one to draft, it is certainly very likely you won't always get to be the person who drafts. And in fact, you will, depends on where you're doing and what you're doing, right? If you're in-house or you're working for a big company in some way and you do similar types of deals over and over again, similar types of licenses, or more to the point, if you are generally speaking the licensor will tend to, most of the time, be the drafting party. Not always, but most of the time. Makes sense. That's its stock in trade, if you'll pardon the expression. That's its business. It's in a better position to figure out what the standard terms are. But on the other hand, if your client or clients are consumers of licenses, they aren't themselves intellectual property vendors, but they, whether it's broadcasters that are consuming everything from programming to software, or whether it's just standard corporations that are bringing in licensed products of some kind, you're more likely to be in that role in a position of reviewing and marking up. So next class, what we're going to do is break into groups, and I'm not going to group you. So maybe what you can do is before the end of today, figure out roughly probably three-ish to a group makes sense. You can do two, but or four if there are four of you are all a study group. But generally speaking, figure three to a group. That should give us enough diversity in our views. And what I'm going to do is email you an agreement and some facts and ask you to mark it up, to make your changes, your proposed changes in class. So you're going to have, this is again next class, gather around a computer and figure out which, we only have an hour and a bit, so which are the high priority things that you want to change and how you want to change them. It's not simply no, no, no. I mean, if that is what you want to do, go ahead. But what I'd like to see is you proposing something in the alternative, figuring out, based on what you know, what changes are necessary for your client and are likely to have some chance. I don't want this just to be the wish list. I want this to be as realistic as it can be. I want this to be you and you as your small law firm, your team, thinking, okay, what do we absolutely need and how can we put it forward in a way that will that will make it most likely that as much of this as possible will get through. It's a strategic decision as well as much as it is a what does my client need, because it's how does my client get what my client needs. So what I want to do is just take a quick second here. Remember the recording's still on, so be careful what you say. Just to grab the printout. Pass that around. Now, at this point, we are not. Am I going to be able to do this? Not comfortably. I've never actually used a document camera. And I don't think today's going to be the day that I start. Okay. All right, Elmo, what are we going to do here? Yes? No? So let's take a look as this goes around. Well, let's read it together, or skim it together, take a couple of minutes to see what it is, what it's talking about, and start thinking about if you were counsel to the Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center. What key issues here might be of most concern, and how would you address them? Just take a few minutes. I will say, as we're doing this, I would love to be able to show you how to hand mark a document. It actually is still relevant at times. There is, well, some of you may be on, I learned it in Law Review, Law Journal. I didn't learn it anywhere else, really. But the whole, anybody here on a journal or Law Review of some kind? Does anybody still teach you how to hand mark things with little squigglies and die? You're nodding, she's shaking her head. So you did it in a course. Okay, so there is actually, there are some standard things that one, and it's not a law thing, it's an editorial thing that editors use. And there are times that you actually do need to hand mark something in a way that someone else will understand. Unfortunately, I think, given our time and other constraints here in this class, it's not really likely to happen. I'd love to do it. Maybe I'll spend 5 minutes just because I think it's an important thing for you guys to know. Because you may see this, right?
Most of the partners of the law firm mark up here work on it.
Right, okay, so. Word, anybody?
Jumps.
Has to be. That's the only place you get the X. The S, I mean. I know. I did that purposely. I really did. Okay. So, the 2-second introduction to what marking up a document can look like. I'm not expecting you necessarily to remember this, but hopefully it's either you could write it down if you haven't seen these things before, or it will at least percolate in your consciousness, so the next time you see it, it won't be totally foreign. So, here are some of the shorthand marking things one does to mark a document up. Let's say you want to delete something. The symbol for deleting is a nice little loopy thing. So, oops, this is spelled wrong. We circle it, nice little loopy thing. That means delete. If you see a capital letter, that should not be a capital letter, a line through it. If I get this backwards because I'm doing it on a board, just let me know, those of you who've seen this. That does not mean erase. If you wanted to erase the F, give it a loop, right? This means it's capitalized and it needs to be lowercase. Similarly, if you see a letter that is lowercase but should be capitalized, some underlines. It's always a good idea, particularly if you've got something like that where it's hard to see. I'm going to leave this up here so you can take a look at it over the put a check on the margins. That simply means, hey, person reading this, there's something on this line. Go look for it. Oh, there it is. Okay. Some other things. You want to put in a space, caret, that's called a caret, right? Nice little box or a half box, space. Before it was a pound key, it was the symbol for a space. Before it was a hash mark and a hashtag, it was the symbol for a space. So this means insert that. Similarly, you want to put in a word, caret. Punctuation also. You want to take this out, delete it, and replace it with an exclamation mark. Here, we want to put in a comma. We don't actually, but a little colon. Now, why do I put this thing there? So that you know it's a comma, it's below the line. It's not an apostrophe. If it weren't an apostrophe, it would be like that. You know, so period. That's how you see a period, right? Colon, semicolon, and so on. So basically, it's not complicated. But, oh. What if you make a change? Oops, I didn't really want to do that. But it's in pen, because I'm brave. I can't erase it. How do I tell people, don't do that change? Put them dots, right? Do step. Step means leave it. The dots mean, nope, didn't mean to do that, and this tells you, nope, don't change. I'm not going to ask you to do this for on Wednesday. In part because if you do it in, say, word processing format, I can mark it, and then we can see exactly where your changes are. But if you are sent a document as a PDF, and you don't have the resources to turn it into, or you're otherwise marking up a letter, you will have need. You will have opportunities to hand mark things. And so it's important for you to know the standard kinds of things that people use in editorial contexts to mark things up. So that if you get someone who has done this, you understand what all the squigglies and the lines and the dots and the check marks and the steps. Got all these right, those of you who've seen this? Again, yeah. Going from
yeah,
this.
The one that shows up all the time is delete a space, it's just that long, elongated S.
That one I haven't really seen because I usually went, okay, it's like that.
Yeah.
Okay, delete a space. got more than will fit in a box. Sometimes you have to take it out, like over here, right? Insert A. That doesn't mean put the phrase insert A. It means, okay, we're going to type up 23 paragraphs, title it insert A, and it's supposed to go right here between over and the. So that's how you deal with more stuff than you can legibly fit in the margin. I feel I've done at least some of my duty showing you old-fashioned things. Let's talk newfangled. All right. None of this is going to be at all useful from the audio recording. That's why we combined. So we have the quick, cute brown box jumps over something, something, something. The lazy, the lad, no, lazy, that's right. Dog. Exclamation mark. Dog. Back to less fun things. Okay, so we have here the BNA license agreement for academic customers. Let's, before we look at the actual text, and that's together. Let's think for a moment about the kinds of things that are unique about your client, the Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center, other than the really excellent chili that is made in the cafeteria. What are the what makes a law school user community different from a corporate user community? If BNA is licensing to a law firm and to an educational institution, all right, what might be different in terms of, let's see, let's go through our journalism questions. Who? What might be different from the licensee point of view for an academic institution as opposed to a corporate institution?
Both have employees, the college has students.
Sure. So that where, if this is something that is to be used by the students, as well as the staff and the faculty, etc., we have to make sure that whatever the license, however the licensee is defined, it includes at least those two populations, where in the ordinary course, a corporate world, if they've got a tool, a database, software, whatever, it's going to be only their employees. Anybody else likely to be using our research facilities besides students? Alumni. Join the Alumni Association. One of the perks is you get to use the library. And in the library, we have all of our electronic research tools. Or lawyers, outsiders coming in. Maybe we have clients in the clinic for some of these tools. Some of our unrepresented litigants may be using our tools to prepare their papers with the support of students. So you really want to think, okay, who are my likely users, and does this license permit? So let's see. Authorized users shall include full-time and part-time, current or visiting members of the faculty, library staff, and currently enrolled students who are permitted to access the customer's secure computer network, regardless of physical location. Authorized users shall also include other persons, for example, walk-ins who are permitted to use the customer's library and access the network from computer terminals located on the library premises. It's not a bad definition they've given us. They forget anybody? Hmm? Well, it does say, well, it depends, right? Maybe it does. Well,
it says that access to terminals
located on the library premises, right? So if it mattered, if we wanted to say in the whole building, what would we do? What would we propose? You know, located, you cross out on the library premises, and you put in. Have we defined the law school? We'd probably want to define the location, right? Located at the customer location. Okay, we don't have alumni. Where would we put them? What?
They mentioned persons.
Well, they could be other persons who are permitted to use the library. But if we have people who aren't necessarily using the library but are using our tools, such as clinic, so where does it carve out alumni? Look at the words. It does. Which students are included in the definition of authorized users? Currently enrolled. That's what I'm saying. It excludes alumni. It doesn't include alumni. It carves them out. Right? So we might need to say, to propose currently enrolled. And they may say, well, you know, that's an awfully big population, in which case you have to make the argument. But you want to read this carefully. Anybody else missing here? Especially since this is a technology tool. There's a really important department.
IT.
Or for that matter, non-faculty staff. Non-faculty, non-library staff. We have all sorts of people here who might need access to these tools. Career services, IT. So again, we might want to say here, members of faculty, what's the most efficient way of changing this to include other staff?
I would say including but not limited to.
You could do that. There's a much simpler way, though. With this text, you want to have as few changes as possible. Cross out the word library. And then it reads, full-time and part-time, current or visiting members of the faculty, staff, and other definition. So you want to think about that who question. And if there are any other who's in our population who need this access, this is where it gets changed. Because as we read through the agreement, this is why you have to be really focused on definitions. Because whatever change is made and ultimately agreed upon to the definition of, quote, authorized users, that term, everywhere it shows up, includes everything in that definition. So the license, right, wherever else authorized users show up, you need to, right, that change applies here. What other who do we need to be at least focused on? Who is the master licensee here? What entity is signing this?
Library.
Well, that might be the person who's signing it, right? On behalf of what entity? Hmm? Which Touro? It's not Touro College, right? This agreement is specific to the law center, which may be fine. But what does that do to the other branches of the college? They're going to need their own agreements if they want to use this tool. So one thing that might be possible would be perhaps to license it for the college. And in fact, a lot of the tools that we use here in the Law Center, we have access to them through an enterprise license obtained by, and not incidentally, often paid for by, college. So wherever the customer here, it's that customer and nowhere else up the chain unless there's some sort of definition in there. The other thing you should just keep in mind, and you would have absolutely no reason to know this, but in many organizations, especially organizations like ours, where they're hierarchical, right? You have parent and subsidiaries. Besides the whole who wants to use it question, many organizations say that for authorize their subsidiaries to enter into contracts only up to X dollars. And beyond X dollars of potential liability, any contract must be entered into by the parent organization. Think of it like a sales rep, an executive who's only got buying authorization for up to $10,000, and everything beyond that has to go to senior management. So it may be, and you just need to know with your client, are there internal restrictions on your client that would make it difficult or inappropriate for your client to be the signatory? Just something about which to be aware. Okay, we got to who. And then of course there's the other who. Because you want to make sure that whichever entity is listed as the licensor is the entity from which you're supposed to be getting the products that you actually want. Here it's a little bit confusing. Who is the licensor in this agreement? BNA, that's the term. To which entity specifically does the term BNA apply in this contract? To which entity? Point to one. Which corporate entity is BNA in this agreement?
Bureau of National Affairs.
No.
And
or its subsidiaries. Actually, this is a very weird definition. This is a poorly written. It is very confusing, and it's vague. On whom would you place any liabilities here? But more to the point, this definition refers to itself. BNA could mean a subsidiary of BNA, which could mean a subsidiary of BNA. Look how it's written, right? The Bureau of National Affairs, Inc., and or a wholly subsidiary of BNA, referred to collectively as BNA. Wait, what? Do you see that problem? Do you? Do you see that the definition essentially depends on itself for its own definition? There are times that people do that, but usually it's to sort of poke fun. Like I'm going to mispronounce it so you know what I'm talking about. The GNU, I know it's not pronounced that way. The GNU open source licenses. Do you know what GNU stands for? It stands for GNU is not Unix. So GNU is not Unix is what GNU stands for. It defines itself by itself. That's an intentional silliness. This is confusing as hell. And probably in practical terms, your client is not going to have a problem with it, but whom would you sue? Against whom would you have the right to sue if BNA breached the agreement? Which BNA? So right there, I've said before, it's very bad to have something in an agreement that one cannot specifically and definitively explain to one's client. Right there, I could not tell my client which entity is signing this agreement, or more to the point, is covered by this agreement. That's a problem. That's something where you want to go back to, if you're representing the college, you want to, or the law center, you want to go back to whomever you're dealing with BNA and say, look, with which BNA entity are we contracting here? Is it the Bureau of National Affairs, Inc., which, by the way, would be a different entity from Bureau of National Affairs Incorporated, or the Bureau of National Affairs Incorporated, or the Bureau of National Affairs, Inc., right? Corporate names must be exact, but in any event, which one are we dealing with, guys? Just pick one, pick two, but tell us, because this doesn't tell us anything. So we've got a who problem on the other side, and we've got things we must have for our client. What is our what? What is being licensed by this license agreement? As usual, the license provision is paragraph number one. What is being licensed here?
Whatever is specified on the order.
What's being licensed? The licensed products are being licensed, aren't they? What are the licensed products? How do we know what the licensed products are?
Some of them should be defined and capitalized.
It is, and where is it defined and capitalized? Look up. Look up right there in the second paragraph. This is where the find command on your computer can be very valuable if you're looking at an electronic copy of something, especially if you say capital L, capital P. The licensed products are whatever is on the order form. And of those things, all databases, software, and or materials contained within them, and accompanying documentation and or manuals. Which means what in terms of a manual? What is your client permitted to do with the manual for the software?
Access and use it.
Right. What isn't your client permitted to do with the manual? Well, whatever is prohibited, what isn't licensed. What putting documentation and manuals into the definition of licensed products does is it makes them subject to the same rights and the same restrictions as the software itself. So let's say your client has 150 users who are, go figure, actually interested in reading the manual. They want to read the manual. Are you permitted to make copies, photocopies, or electronically distributed copies of the manual? Answer? Whatever the agreement says. If the agreement says you're permitted to make copies of the licensed products for license for authorized users, yes. If it doesn't, no. You may not photocopy the manual. Even though the only reason you're doing so is to use the software, because it's put into the definition of licensed products, all of the rights and all of the restrictions that apply to, quote, licensed products apply to that too. The other thing you need to remember about the what is, well, a few things. First of all, if there's a specific product your client, the Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center, wants from BNA, it darn well better be on that order form, or you don't, your client doesn't have any rights to it. If there's a new product that comes out, how does your client get access to it? BNA comes up with a new publication, we want it. What has to happen? Well, how do we know if we can supplement the agreement? We need to look and see. It says here, amendment. This is way at the end. That's why these miscellaneous provisions aren't always casual. No modification or claimed waiver of any provision of this agreement shall be valid except by written amendment signed by authorized representatives of BNA and customer. So in order to have a new product, that has to be either a separate license agreement or a formal amendment countersigned. A letter from them is not going to necessarily be sufficient. Having access to it, you know, there's a menu on the software, and because it's online, whatever, and suddenly there's a new option because they have a new product, absent a written amendment signed by authorized representatives, anybody using that, even though it shows up, is violating the license. This is the statement of rights and liabilities. And unless there's another one, this is the only statement. So we have the what. What other whats might you need to be concerned with? This is a digital product of some sort. May also be a print product of some sort. So it's not only the what in terms of the titles. You may have a very specific version. Version for Windows, version for Macs, version for tablets. Paper version, electronic version. There was a time when if one subscribed to the paper versions of West, the West publications, the electronic versions came as part of the package. Then the electronic versions started having more value, and I think they stopped that. So you need to think about not only what packages, what products, but in what form? Does your client need them? Because that has to be here. Has to be an obligation placed on the licensor to deliver them in the form your client needs. Okay? Where? Who, what, where? Are we going with when? Let's go with where. What's our where here? Is where even defined? Might not be. But we have some wares, right? In the original draft. Well, what tells you that it's here? Okay. Where is the customer's library? The only physical location designated there is what? Tell me the address of customer where authorized users may use it. There? Now that may be to our benefit, by the way, as right? Because it means, okay, we can set up our library, quote unquote, anywhere. Wherever, you know. You know, Billy Joel says, wherever we're together, that's my home. Well, wherever our books are, that's our library. Doesn't say where. That could be a benefit to us. It also allows people to remotely access, which is also important. But if we want to make sure that this facility is designated as an authorized location, we probably want to add it in to avoid any questions. The other where is devices. Where, on what devices will this product be permissibly used? And as we read through, it tells us on the fourth page, section 6B, for their individual use. Well, that's right. View the licensed product on screen. May download or save to a computer disk. Computer disk. How many of you currently own something that could be called a computer disk? Disk, an actual disk that you can download stuff to. You do. You have a disk?
I have blank disks.
You have CDs. Okay. What?
Doesn't a thumb drive pop?
Well,
up as a removable disk?
It does say, or it says removable drive or something, but what if you want to, again, what does computer disk mean? We don't know. It could be anything. I have floppy disks at home. I do have a few left around. They're not big 5 1/4 inch floppies. Actually, I probably have some of those too. A little 3 1/2 inch. Maybe I have a drive. But if you want your users to be able to move to save things not just on however you would define a disk, but also a thumb drive, a memory card, a tablet, a phone, some other kind of storage medium, 6B has to change. You have to mark it up. You have to say, not just on computer disks, but save it on computer storage or portable storage or something that's going to be a, because that's, this might be, I don't remember from when this agreement dates, but there are times that people just don't focus on those provisions that have been in there forever, and they just leave it there. And it's not a problem until BNA wants to say that we've breached the agreement, and they could point to it and say, this just says disk. That's a thumb drive. It's not a disk. There's nothing spinning. You violated. We get to pull the products or whatever. Vagueness, bad. Broad detail, if you're the licensee, good. All right, we also have, if BNA is properly credited, authorized users may, on an occasional basis, reproduce and use small portions of material in the licensed products for internal or inter-office use, coursework for educational or research use, court filings by student legal clinics, and or classroom use as provided for under United States copyright. copyright law. Fair use provisions. What's wrong with that provision? What's wrong with that where? Also, that's sort of a how, but... Come back to my point. Come back to the question. Your client asks you, may I or may I not? Can you, from that sentence, definitively give your client a yes or no answer to every use? How many times may it be used in an office? How many times may it be used in a classroom? Or by a student in court? How many times? Your client wants to know, how many times a year are we allowed to use this in a classroom? And you look at this provision, and what's your answer? That's your answer. Uh-huh. Oh. I don't know how to spell that. Hopefully it's not an emailed answer, because does it really spell properly? Record an audio file. You don't know. Occasional. How much of the material am I allowed to use in classroom? How much?
Small portions.
3 ounces? 4 ounces? How much is a small portion? Let's say I'm okay with the small and I'm okay with the occasional. What do I need to do? What's the obligation that I, the client, have in order to be permitted to use occasionally small bits of this? What's my condition precedent here? What's the prerequisite for any of those uses?
Properly
credited BNN. Okay. What does that mean? What? Pay them? Credit their accounts? Put things on the screen? Verbally say, thank you, BNA! Good night! Whatever it is. This whole provision. Now, I'm railing about this provision because it's chock full of uncertainty. Remember the parole evidence rule, right? You're not supposed to go to the intention of the parties if the language is clear. Well, here we have whatever the opposite of the language is, but you don't know. Oddly enough, they're actually sort of saying nothing. I'll tell you why. Look at how that sentence ends. Provided for, now it's, again, is it just talking about classroom use there? I'm not sure. Provided for under United States copyright law fair use provisions. Isn't that nice of them? They are permitting our client, out of the goodness of their corporate heart, to use things that are permitted for us to use under the law, no matter what they say. Remember, they may not license a right they don't have. They may not provide a restriction the law doesn't permit them to provide. So it may well be that the intention here was actually sort of an advisory intention. By the way, we got whatever's here, that's fine, but don't forget fair use. Maybe, maybe not. Let me ask you the practical lawyering question. How much time and effort and energy and negotiation capital are you likely to spend arguing about this really poorly drafted provision in your negotiations with BNA? You don't know what it means. We can't. There's just too many uncertainties here for us to adequately counsel our clients. how important is this provision? How much time are you likely to spend? How much energy are you likely to spend pushing BNA to edit this? All right, so let's think practically. How likely is it that this provision would be the meat for a lawsuit by BNA?
It is for copyright.
Hmm?
It is for copyright infringement.
It is, except what's it talking about? It's talking about fair use.
Yeah, but you spend zero time negotiating.
You'd spend zero time, that's right. You might, again, this is where I give you the how I do things as a lawyer. And we're going to get, I'm going to give you a lot of that stuff and feel free to disregard. But here's how I see this. There are certain provisions, like, and I think we looked at it briefly and we'll come back to it again. Your client shall, the services shall be of a professional nature, you know, equal to those skilled in the area and shall be done. Things that, I don't know what that means, but okay, fine, you're not, you know, go argue that I was unprofessional. This, how likely, right? Okay, so first of all, I've got fair use. No matter what BNA says, I've got fair use to fall back on for occasional use, for partial use, in the classroom. We're a not-for-profit educational institution. We're not immune by any stretch to fair use violations, but we're more likely to succeed in a fair use defense than, say, a corporation, a for-profit corporation using an entire work that it could afford to pay for just because it didn't want to have pay for it. I think it's the Texaco case, one of the biggest copyright infringement cases ever. $100+ million. I think it was Texaco. It was definitely one of the big oil companies. What was the fact pattern? They were taking publications, journals, newsletters, whatever, and duplicating them across the organization. Copy would come in. You know, here's the Journal of Petroleum Science. Photocopy, send around. And said the court, you could have gotten more subscriptions. This was simply you're trying to save money on multiple subscriptions. And you weren't just taking one and then handing it off. No, you were photocopying the whole thing and handing, you know, and sending the articles around. And that's a no-no. And you can't make a fair use argument because you were using the whole thing and there was an easy way. You were already paying for it, so you knew how and you knew to whom. And that is why, if you're in an organization now, and it's true here as well, and you have a librarian, and the librarian is sending around articles of interest. Anybody do this? Anybody get these? What does the librarian send around? They send around the table of contents. Here's the latest publication. If you'd like to see any of the articles, let us know. They don't send around the whole publication. They don't photocopy it. They don't scan it and duplicate it because Texaco, because you get a lot of damages. But we're not in that situation. We're likely, in the kinds of uses that we have, to be falling under fair use. All right? And we're probably more likely than not to credit where credit is due, because we're academics. So yeah, this is a badly worded provision. And yes, it does go to the substantive law that is the point of the exercise, is the point of the agreement. But you have to pick your battles. What you might be able to use this for, right, is a little bit, I'm not a big believer in leverage for leverage's sake. I win, you lose. No, but there's something to be said, and I'm sure that if my colleague, Professor Abramson, who, of course, knows this, knows the idea of negotiation, and, you know, that's his specific worldwide expertise field. So talk to him because I'll get it probably much less right than he will. But there's always something about negotiation and giving and taking, and right? This one is a gimme, or a giveaway, I should say. This is one where what you might do is say, well, you know, this provision, I really don't understand it, and it's all sorts of vague. Could we change it? And they're likely to say, no, look, this is just, this is what it's going to be. And you say, well, okay, I guess. But then, of course, then you need something changed later on in the negotiation. You can say, look, we gave in on 6B, right? Can you work with us here? Seriously, it's stupid. It sounds stupid because you were 6B is irrelevant, and you both knew it. But there's something there. You can use those sorts of things at least a little. At least a little to say, okay, look, I made my point. You heard me. I'm not going to push you. We want to get done today. That's fine. I get it. You don't have authority to change this anyway. I know you see the same problems. You're a smart opposing counsel. But look, we didn't make trouble with that one. Can you work with us on this one? Here's a proposal. We think it's okay, etc. You can do that stuff. And that's how I would use this. I wouldn't just ignore it because it's bad. And maybe you're not going to get a change, but maybe the person you're dealing with will go back. You know, we could be altruistic, right? We're going to improve we're going to pay forward. I hate that movie. But we're going to pay forward our contract knowledge. So hopefully the next time BNA sits down to revise its standard agreement, someone's going to sit back and say, you know, they were right. This is really awkwardly, unclearly drafted. Let's fix it. And then karma will benefit you. But in the meanwhile, you could use it for, I gave in on that. You give in. Of course, we have a when here, right? When is important. Do we have a clear when here? You always start on the whens. There are a couple whens here. When does it start? How long does it last? When does it end? When does it start? When does it start? And here's where you have an exception to the quote-unquote rule I told you about the other day. What triggers this agreement's effectiveness? First page, near the top. Nope, that's not, that just tells you it's effective when it's effective. What makes it start being effective? Look at the third, yeah.
Access to render using
less products. Mm-hmm, keep going. This is a shrink wrap license. A business to business, large enterprise to large enterprise, probably fairly expensive shrink wrap license. And I would actually suggest that if you were representing Turo in this context, and I don't even remember where and how I got this. I don't know if it was given to me to review. I wasn't negotiating it, that I'm pretty sure. Over the years, they've sort of asked me to take a quick look because I've done more of these than anybody else in the building. Because I'm a technology lawyer. And so anyway, I don't know where I got this from. It's clearly a Turo agreement of some kind. But if I were in the process of negotiating this, especially given what we already read about how amendments happen, I would actually ask them to change this. I would ask them to change this to, it's effective upon mutual signature. Why? Just because I'm difficult. What risk does my client, the Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center, face here that it wouldn't if we're talking about signature? I was going for BNB and I went to BNA. I don't know about accident.
Unauthorized person could access it.
Or even an authorized person who's not a decision maker. The first time a student or, you know, looks at one of these databases, the entire organization is bound. No matter where we are in the potential negotiations, that's where I have a problem. Because this is a significant agreement. This is not shrink wrap software. It's not iTunes. It's not a video game. This is something for which the school is paying and probably paying a lot. And dealing with a lot of enforcement responsibilities. And being on the hook in case some authorized user or some unauthorized user does things in an unauthorized way. And all of that exposure and all that liability and all that potential cost gets triggered when one person clicks on a read this database. I'm not comfortable with that. That's why even the mechanism for effectiveness, you have to think about, does it make sense or is it unnecessarily risky for my client? How will you know? Let's say, you know, the payment terms, we didn't really look at these. We are paying all sorts of things. They get triggered the moment someone uses this? I'm not so sure I'm comfortable with that. I don't know.
I mean,
and that
might
be
like
the response.
Like the thing, but
right? But what about, you know, but of all the terms and conditions, I don't know what a librarian is. What if it's an evaluation copy? Right? Someone has got a copy to trade show. Or, you know, our librarian's at another place or in a law firm, somebody's using it. What triggers it? When? Who? Why? I don't know. But if I'm going to be right,
So they even capitalize the return underneath payment. They don't say anything in here that defines it.
Where are we capitalizing term?
Under payment
section. Okay, let's see. Okay, is term not defined?
I can't find anywhere that it's defined.
Is that supposed to go back to the order form?
I don't know. It could. Right, so you see that again. We're going beyond the sort of what does the contract mean, and we're getting into what does my client need, and how does that need get reflected, or how is it not well reflected in the agreement I've been given. And the purpose of marking up, whether you're doing it with squigglies and dots and carrots and things like that, or you're making a change to an electronic version, it's always good. Save it, save the original, then save the new one. Whether or not you're turning on mark changes or not, it is always better to save the original and then save it again with a new name, because you don't want to overwrite anything. You want to be able to track your changes. But whatever the mechanism is, the purpose of marking it up, the purpose of proposing changes, for one purpose is to make sure that what your client needs is properly and fully in the agreement. Two is to make sure that what your client can't live with is out. And three, to make sure that whatever things your client might be able to live with, would prefer not to, are there, but only as far as your client's capable and, you know, able comfortably to live with them. And so as you propose changes to the language, right, so you think about and you read and you review and you mark the contract for your client's point of view, but you also want to get a signed contract. And so when you make a proposed change, as you're doing it, put yourself to the extent you can, and the longer you're in practice, the more likely you are to end up negotiating on both, I don't want to say on both sides, but from each point of view. At some point over the years, you'll probably represent licensors and licensees in separate deals. And the more you do that, the more you have a sense of, even if you don't know the secret stuff, the behind the scenes stuff, but you'll have a reasonable and improving sense of what kinds of changes your opposing counsel, the opposing party, is going to be able and then willing to accept. Able is the real problem. If you propose something it's not able to accept, it won't. Willing is a question of convincing and trading and everything else. And this comes in places like the payment structure, where your client may be told you have to pay us on a 30-day basis, and your client's financial system only runs invoices every 60 days. And it would cost you more than the contract is worth to change your whole financial system for one deal. Or it tells you have to put in place particular technology that you don't have. That's where, that's a can't. Yeah. Did you have a hand?
Last thing, it says executed the screen of the record as of the subscription of our date.
I'm not claiming this is a particularly well drafted, consistent document. And no disrespect meant to BNA. I don't recall where this came from and how and et cetera. But gives you a sense, it's not a bad agreement, all right? It seems reasonably well organized. It's mostly free of typos. It's the kind of thing that your client's not going to spot, but that's why we read it differently than our clients do, and that's why we focus on these things. So work out your groups. I'm going to send you the fact pattern. I'm going to send you the proposed agreement from the other side. We're going to come in next class, sit down, group up, and make, talk about your changes and make the ones, given the time frame, right? Make the most important ones. You're going to then send them to me. I'm going to review them, and then we'll go over them together the way we did your proposed language. All right, questions, thoughts, comments? Have a good night.